It's time
for a solid hour of Tea Party Power.
And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. My name is Mark Gillar. I'll be your host as we visit with two very special guests, Douglas Schoen, who along with Scott Rasmussen is the author of Mad as Hell, How the Tea Party Movement is Fundamentally Remaking Our Two-Party System. And then next we'll be visiting with Jerome Corsi, the author of The Obama Nation, Leftist Politics and a Cult of Personality. This is one of my favorite books back during the 2008 election. We'll touch base with Dr. Corsi and see just how many of his predictions have come true. But first up, Douglas Schoen. In addition to being the co-author of Mad as Hell, he is also one of the co-founders of the landmark political polling firm of Penn, Schoen, and Berland. He is a moderate Democrat who is a Fox News contributor. I'm sure you guys are used to seeing him there every night. And he publishes editorials for the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Forbes.com, Politico, and a place where I've been banned from posting, the Huffington Post. Let's get right to it. Doug, you said in your book that the most polarizing question in American politics today is, what is the Tea Party movement? I'm going to put you on the spot. What is the Tea Party movement?
It's a movement of dedicated citizens committed to smaller government, reducing the deficit, and returning to core constitutional principles.
Doug, you mentioned in your book that the roots of the Tea Party may go as far back as the presidential bid of Ross Perot. If you'll pardon the pun, is this Tea Party movement something that's been simmering in the American political psyche for some time?
Absolutely. There's frustration with both parties, Democrats and Republicans alike, and the Tea Party is a reaction against bloated government, big spending by both the Bush and Obama administration. So while it's expressed itself as a right-wing Republican movement, it is nonpartisan and it is a reflective of outrage with both the Democrats and the Republicans.
You point out in your book that there's actually a rather diverse mixture. I mean, obviously predominantly Republican, but there are a number of Democrats and independents in this movement as well.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, about a third of Tea Party members voted for Obama, half are... We looked at it this spring, were independents or Democrats, the other half are Republicans. So I don't see the Tea Party movement as just a monolithically Republican movement, not by a long shot.
Now, another study that I saw that surfaced suggested that while a lot of people, perhaps due to the mainstream media, have a negative opinion of the Tea Party, when you rattle off some of those principles that the Tea Party believes in, as you did in the beginning, people tend to support a lot of the planks of the Tea Party movement, but just don't seem to support the title or don't support, you know, the idea of a Tea Party. Is that correct?
That is exactly right. I think, first of all, it's about a quarter of America does support the Tea Party, but that being said, it is certainly the case that if you think about it, when you ask people about reducing the debt, reducing the deficit, cutting spending, returning to core principles, you get in excess of 50-55% who indicate assent with those core principles, and it's bipartisan and across the board.
What role do you think that the Internet and the social media has played in the development of the Tea Party?
Absolutely critical. Without the Internet and social media, there would not be a Tea Party, because it's the way a leaderless movement has sprung up around the country, where viral power is as important as top-down power.
One of the things that's been thrown at the Tea Party is the accusation of racism. Do you think that there is a significant component of the Tea Party membership that is racist?
If it exists, I haven't seen it, nor do I think my colleague Scott Rasmussen has. I mean, there's been a lot of people who sort of say that since most Tea Party members are white, that that's ipso facto a sign of racism. I couldn't disagree more. I think that there certainly are a couple of wackos who've said some things that are unacceptable and unpalatable, but the vast, vast majority of Tea Party people are people of goodwill, God-fearing, who want the best for this country and are just very upset with what's happened.
Whenever a response like that is given to those who oppose the Tea Party or those who don't trust the Tea Party, they'll typically come back and say, you know what, Bush ran up an incredible deficit as well, and yet the Tea Party didn't spring into action during the Bush administration. The fact that the Tea Party seemed tolerant of Bush's spending but intolerant of Obama's spending would suggest that it is, in fact, a racist organization. Why did the Tea Party manifest itself when it did, as opposed to during the Bush administration?
Well, I think it had its roots in the Bush administration. I think the bailouts were certainly responsible for helping to form the Tea Party, but I think if you go back to Rick Santelli's rant and the protests on April 15th, 2009, I don't think there was anyone then who said that was racist. A lot of people said it wasn't real, it didn't exist, blah, 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 but it wasn't racist. But, I mean, to just sort of say, well, they reacted against Obama, not Bush, even though they're free, and they do criticize Bush pretty zealously from everything I've read and heard, I mean, that kind of logic to me is abhorrent, because it's like, you know, if you bumped into an African-American male on the street and you got very upset, well, why didn't you get upset the last time you hit a white guy in the street? I mean, there's really no way to answer that other than to look at the facts of what's happened, and the facts suggest that race just didn't have anything to do with it.
We've seen attempts to label the Tea Party in numerous ways. Initially, I think all of us remember Nancy Pelosi coming on and saying, this isn't grassroots, it's AstroTurf. It's being manufactured by the insurance industry, or it's being manufactured by Fox News. But this is not a real grassroots movement, and at least that seemed to be the prevailing opinion on the part of many at that time. Do you think that even among those who once dismissed the Tea Party, there is an evolving opinion, and that perhaps there is more respect toward the Tea Party at this point?
Well, I think there's recognition that it's certainly not AstroTurf and certainly is real. I think the left, rather than trying to work with the Tea Party or understand its roots and the reason it exists, what the left has done is to systematically pretend that the Tea Party in some way is illegitimate. It's either not real, created by outside forces, the people are being manipulated, they're racially driven, whatever. I mean, and it's made very little sense to me and continues to.
Yeah, you do a good job of detailing a lot of the bashing that has taken place, and I think my favorite line was that you listed was, you know, that we're all a bunch of knuckle-dragging hillbillies.
Well, how can a quarter of the American people be, you know, just demonized like that? I mean, it makes no earthly sense. That is, and what's so troubling to me is I think you can disagree with some of the things the Tea Party movement might say without demonizing the people or the movement or the cause. And the fact that we are so polarized says as much about the critics as it does about the movement.
Excellent point. One of the things that I think intrigues me is the label that the Tea Party is violent or dangerous. And many people think that the Tea Partiers, you know, are just ready to take up arms and engage in a battle of some sort. It seems to me that the Tea Party movement tests that we've seen have been relatively peaceful compared to, say, for instance, young people protesting about global warming in Copenhagen.
Well, I guess my reaction is I don't tend to want to compare apples to oranges. My attitude is very simple. You look at the protests the Tea Parties have engaged in, there have been literally thousands of them, if not tens of thousands, and I defy you to point to one violent Tea Party rally. I can't. Again, the worst that I could say is that there have been a few people in the Tea Party movement who have said and done some foolish things, and they have been appropriately isolated as a result, which is what, to me, is right, reasonable and appropriate.
What impact do you see the Tea Party having on November 2nd?
I think
the Tea
Party movement, I think, were critically important to a nominating 6 Republican candidates for Senate, and I think we could have up to 6 Tea Party senators elected, and I think the Tea Party movement will be directly responsible, the most important organization, if it can be called an organization, responsible for what I believe will be the Republican takeover of at least one House of Congress.
Do you see the Tea Party as having staying power over the long haul? Because a lot of people have also dismissed it as a temporary reaction to the bailouts and perhaps to the economic situation, but they don't see it being here 5-10 years from now. What are your thoughts?
Well, time will tell. I mean, look, if we get our fiscal house in order, there probably won't be any need for the Tea Parties, but given everything we've read and heard, I think we're going to see the Tea Parties at the very least for the 2012 election.
Do you think there's a chance that it would ever evolve into a true third party?
I think it's certainly possible. I mean, I think there's the support and the sustenance in the electorate to do that, but at this point, it is part and parcel of the Republican Party, though, as I pointed out before, its members are very clear that they have almost as many gripes with how the past Republican Bush administration conducted itself as they do with the current Obama administration.
I've attended numerous Tea Parties, and I've got to be honest, I've yet to see a racist sign, but the signs that stand out to me, and pardon the language, are the ones that say Republicans suck too, or Bush sucked too. There does seem to be a lot of anger toward the Republican Party as well. There is.
And I mean, if you talk as I have to Tea Party people, what they'll tell you typically, the sort of stereotypical message is the following. Look, I'm new to politics, but I'm angry. I was angry at Bush. I'm really angry at Obama. I feel that we're losing our country. I'm losing control of the core values that I care about. And we're spending ourselves into oblivion, and we got to do something about it. And that's why I'm out here protesting. That's the core message.
I agree with you. I meet those people every single day who will tell me that, you know, I always voted, but that was kind of the extent of my political involvement. But I finally just decided, you know, hey, if I don't want to see this country go over a cliff, I'm going to have to do something. And when I've been to Tea Parties and I see people of many different colors there, I see young college students, I see people who are retired, and all of them are saying, you know, I've never really had that much of an interest in politics. But, you know, all of a sudden I realize if I don't stand up and do something now, you know, sooner or later it's going to be too late. We're going to end up looking like those people who were protesting on the streets of Greece, or, you know, we're going to end up being, you know, some other European socialist experiment. Without being critical, a lot of people have said that Dick Morris is being overly optimistic in his predictions that the Republicans will take over the House and the Senate. Do the Republicans really have a chance to win back the Senate at this point?
Sure. What I said, my estimates show be about 50 to 60 seats in the House, about, at this point, 7 to 8 in the U.S. Senate, and if there is a tidal wave on Election Day, you could get one or two more seats for the Republicans in the Senate, but if I had to bet, I'd bet against the Republicans.
Fair enough. I appreciate you sharing your prediction with us this close
sure.
to the election.
You're very kind. I think it was a very good interview, and I look forward to follow-up conversations after the election if you think that would be helpful.
Doug, it certainly would be helpful. In fact, I don't think there's anybody out there who surveys the political landscape better than you. Thank you for being with us today. We look forward to having you back very, very soon.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to WGRV in Flatonia, Texas, the flagship station of the Tea Party Power Hour.
My next guest is Dr. Jerome Corsi, who received his Ph.D. from Harvard University in political science in 1972. He is the number one New York Times best-selling author of The Obama Nation and The Late Great USA, as well as an e-book, and this is now actually available in paperback because I have it, Why Israel Can't Wait. He's also the author of America for Sale, and he is the co-author of Unfit for Command, Swift Boat Veterans Speak Out Against John Kerry. And as if all that weren't enough, Corsi is also a senior staff reporter for World Net Daily. Dr. Corsi, it is an honor to have you with us today on the Tea Party Power Hour.
Oh, well, thanks. I'm delighted to be with you.
I got to tell you, Dr. Corsi, as I reread The Obama Nation in preparation for today's interview, the question that kept popping into my head was, is he going to write a follow-up called I Told You So?
Well, I mean, thank you for that. But I tried to tell people that Barack Obama was and is an ideologue, that he is radically left. He's trained that way. He was brought up that way. He's Saul Alinsky trained, which means that he's very good at masking it and hiding who he truly is. That was the core of Saul Alinsky's training. You know, he dedicated Rules to Radicals to Lucifer, you know, his Prince of Lies, and he embraced Machiavelli, who taught that it's better to appear to be good than to be good. And so, you know, politicians were taught under Saul Alinsky's method to cut their hair, to tell people what they wanted to hear, and then when they got into office, redistribute income and put in a socialist state. And that's exactly what I thought Barack Obama would do, and he's done everything he can to fulfill that Saul Alinsky mission.
You pretty much sniffed out his redistribution policies well before the Joe the Plumber incident.
Yes, I was onto that early on because, I mean, this has been a fundamental tenet of the far left. The far left is what's taken over the Democratic Party. It used to be considered in the 60s the new left. Well, new left was code words for meaning the socialists and communists have come in to take over from the Hubert Humphrey liberals. The Democratic Party used to be dominated by politicians who were really very tame by today's standards. John Kennedy, remember, came in and cut taxes. Hubert Humphrey had a concern for labor unions, but he was not for the redistribution of income that the far left wants. The far left really believes that the capitalist state and all of private enterprise oppresses the poor and needs to be dismantled. And the tactic since the 50s, and Saul Alinsky probably best epitomized it, was to teach the left how to appear to be moderate in order to gain power. And so instead of the Democratic Party today being dominated by the Hubert Humphreys and Jack Kennedys, it's dominated by the Bill Ayers types who want to move, you know, for whom Barack Obama is not left enough. But I knew that Barack Obama was going to come in and his primary mission was going to be to redistribute income, take anybody who's got any money, give it to somebody who doesn't have any money, increase the power of government, and do everything he can to, in a Cloward and Piven way, the two sociologists from Columbia who were there when Barack Obama was there, to break the society so that capitalism was shown to be a failure and it could be reconstructed with a socialist state. That's the agenda. And Barack Obama has signed on to that agenda since he was a young man.
Now, he's not just about redistributing wealth within the United States, but you know, based on some of the decisions he's made and what I anticipate he will make regarding cap and trade, it would seem that he's also very much in favor of spreading the U.S.'s wealth around the world.
Well, that's also been one of the primary tenets of Marxism going back to the 20s, and that is that the United States had gained wealth by, again, stealing resources, oppressing labor worldwide, and the only way to advance was to reduce and break the power of the United States and redistribute that wealth to the poorer nations. Now, Barack Obama is going to sign on to that agenda with the plan to destroy the U.S. dollar. He's gone along with the G20 nations and Robert Mundell's plan. Robert Mundell's the economist at Columbia who designed the euro. I wrote about him extensively when I wrote America for Sale. And, you know, in that book, I tried to point out that the next thing that the globalists want to do is destroy the dollar and put the IMF in control. And the IMF has done another thing I predicted it would do. It just did it last week. And that is they voted to give the countries like Brazil, Russia, India, and China more voting power. So they're preparing the IMF to be the global currency of the future in international trade. And Barack Obama will go along with redistributing the wealth of the United States. Barack Obama, remember, campaigned saying that he was going to renegotiate NAFTA. In fact, Austin Goolsbee, his economic advisor during the campaign, went off to Canada and said, oh, so it's just wink, wink, don't, Barack Obama doesn't mean this. That got publicized, and Austin Goolsbee during the campaign got very publicly fired by the Obama team. Well, Goolsbee's back in the White House. He's managing the Council of Economic Advisors. It always was wink, wink. Barack Obama, the fundamental reality about Barack Obama, you've got to realize, is he'll tell you what you want to hear, so nothing that he says means anything except to be calculated for the moment to be something that will appease you and make you like him and go with him. He doesn't mean anything he says. He's got a disconnect between his words and his ideas. He'll never tell you his ideas. The words that you hear, Saul Alinsky trained, are going to be what he's listened to you and knows he can parrot back to you to win your favor. They don't have anything to do with what he believes. It's like the gear that should connect his words and his ideas is disconnected. That's the key understanding of a Saul Alinsky politician.
Didn't Saul Alinsky's son write an op-ed or perhaps just submit a letter to a publication regarding how well Barack Obama had used his father's tactics?
Yeah, I think there is. I've got to start quoting that and looking for that. But, you know, to me, just reading Saul Alinsky, and there's pictures of Barack Obama in a classroom setting, and he's drawing Saul Alinsky power diagrams on a blackboard. Anybody who went through Saul Alinsky, you know, remembers him from the 1960s, remembers those, you know, those power diagrams, boxes showing the establishment and where power was held and how to break up the power, the banks, the big business, the educational institutions. You know, this was the power elite ideas that, you know, Wilbur Mills was, I mean, these were ideas that go back in terms of, I give you lots of the congressmen and lots of the different people that he's come from out of the Democratic Party, but like the fundamental idea of Saul Alinsky was communist driven. And again, Saul Alinsky wouldn't call himself a communist. Just like Frank Marshall Davis. I mean, the black poet and journalist from Chicago who retired in Hawaii and was a mentor to Obama growing up. Saul Alinsky, Frank Marshall Davis, these guys would say they weren't communists. Well, if you go through the records, you know, the House Un-Americans Activities Committee and the others had Frank Marshall Davis's number in the Communist Party. He was a member of the Communist Party in the 30s. Valerie Jarrett's family comes out of the same Communist Party roots in Chicago. She's in the White House, about to be, I think, the next chief of staff, or at least very prominent again in the advising of the new circle of policy advisors that Barack Obama puts around him. So, you know, you've got here a radical inner circle that all is wink, wink. They're on a globalist mission, and, you know, they want to redistribute the wealth of the United States internally and then around the world, and key to it is to reduce the power of the United States. That's one of the fundamental principles here. But again, Barack Obama will never fess up to any of this. He'll never tell it to you. He'll show up with a smile and, you know, talk about how he believes in capitalism, talk about how he believes in Jesus Christ, that he's a Christian. He just knows that that's what you need to hear. Doesn't mean he's a Christian. Doesn't mean he even believes in God.
Would you probably add to that his comment that he has always believed the Second Amendment is an individual right?
Oh, Barack Obama in the state Senate in Illinois went after, it was a restaurant owner up in one of the Chicago suburbs who had a double home invasion, and he finally shot at the intruder the second time the intruder came back into his house, same intruder. And Barack Obama wanted to prosecute the homeowner because he had a gun that had not been re-registered under a recent re-registration law. Wanted to prosecute him. And, you know, the Illinois legislature passed a law basically making it clear that this guy had done nothing wrong. And Barack Obama also, it's the other case I wrote about in the Obama Nation and the legislature where the baby that survived the late-term abortion, and Barack Obama wanted the baby to be killed. So the mother had an absolute right to abortion. So the baby survived the abortion. Tough luck. The mother's choice took over, and the baby could be killed. I mean, this is Barack Obama when you really understand who he is. You can't look at what he says. You've got to look at what he does.
He does seem to have the ability to look into a camera and say whatever people want to hear. One of the examples that stands out in my mind is his speech in Selma, Alabama, where he essentially was trying to establish his false civil rights roots by saying that he was here, meaning on the planet, because some people marched across a bridge, Selma, Alabama. And we now know that march took place 4 years after he was born. You point out in your book, The Life magazine article, that he completely made up for convenience. And one of my favorite examples of him looking into a camera and telling people what they want to hear is I have a video clip of him in Ohio speaking to the SEIU, and he said, you know, we've passed a landmark stimulus bill, unprecedented, and we did it without the usual pork barrel spending that you see in Washington.
It's unbelievable. Mark, you know, look, also,
yeah.
He claimed his father was here in the United States because of Jack Kennedy. Well, I did the research.
Right.
You know, there was an airlift. There were a couple of airlifts from Kenya that brought students here. They were organized by Tom Mamboya. And the first airlift had nothing to do with Jack Kennedy. You know, the second airlift had to do with Jack Kennedy. Barack Obama's father wasn't on either one of the airlifts. Barack Obama's father came here on his own money before either of the airlifts had started. I went into the Jackie Robinson papers, because Jackie Robinson worked with Tom Mamboya in Kenya to organize these student airlifts. And the first one was in 1959. And I'm looking in the Jackie Robinson papers in the National Archives. Barack Obama's father is not listed on the list. He's nowhere on the list. He's not in any of the papers. There's no reference whatsoever. I've got the photographs of the students. Barack Obama's father isn't in it. So I finally had to research it. I went back to the Hawaii newspapers from 59, went back to the sources, you know, that were of the universities themselves. Barack Obama's father arrived in Hawaii before either of the airlifts. Jack Kennedy, who only contributed to the second airlift, did not have anything to do with Barack Obama's father being in the United States, but that's what Barack Obama claimed. Another lie.
It's
another,
a great story.
I mean, you know, he has no... Barack Obama, I called him, and when I wrote Abomination, I warned people that he's what I call a hypothetical liar. A hypothetical liar is kind of a psychological term that means that somebody reinvents stories about themselves, typically wrapping themselves up into history, that are completely false, made up. But they themselves become to believe it so strongly that it becomes part of their psychological reality. And they'll tell it to you as if it were true. You won't know until you go research it that his father wasn't there, or the events he's making up happened after he was born, you know, like the Selma thing. I mean, when he was saying it was responsible for his birth. This is typical Barack Obama. Also, the other thing about Barack Obama that when you come to realize, I try to point it out in Abomination, is that not only does he lie about everything, including fundamental facts about his life, but he's not that good with history. He's not that good with many things. He makes a lot of stuff up that he, you know,
sorry,
that invents. You know, and then when you get back and you trace it down, there may be some context to some reality. You know, he said grandfather helped to release the Jews out of the concentration camps. Well, it turns out that one of his uncles was in one of the advanced units, I believe, of Patton's Third Army that did get one of the sub-camps released. But his father... his grandfather, you know, Stanley Dunham, did not participate in releasing anybody from any concentration camps. It's typical Barack Obama. And the press does not call him on this stuff.
There certainly has been a reluctance on the part of the mainstream media to call him on anything. I'm wondering if you feel, in the wake of the Jon Stewart interview, if that might be about to change.
No, I mean, Jon Stewart made Barack Obama look to be a fool, but anybody who would press Barack Obama hard could make him look to be a fool. Barack Obama is very thin-skinned, and he reacts immediately. You can see how edgy Barack Obama got as soon as Jon Stewart accused Barack Obama of not being far enough left or appointing people into his administration who were the same people that George W. Bush would appoint. Barack Obama didn't like those criticisms, and he immediately bristled at them, engaged in long answers trying to self-justify. And Jon Stewart just ridiculed him. He made him, you know, he called him dude. He ridiculed him. But, you know, Barack Obama has done everything he can to reduce the symbolic importance of the office. He bops up and down the stairs of Air Force One like he was, you know, on a treadmill. He wears his jeans and his baseball hat, plays golf in these cutoffs, doesn't have the proper golf attire. He'd be thrown out of most country clubs in the United States for walking in their door looking like he comes out on the golf course to play. It looks like he just got off the streets of Chicago. Michelle's no better. You know, take a look at how Michelle and Barack Obama look on Air Force One compared to George W. Bush and his wife. You know, they were always sharply dressed, respectful. Barack Obama's a slouch. He likes to go to the gym. He enjoyed smoking lots of dope when he was a kid. He still drinks pretty heavily, and he still smokes pretty heavily, but he hides all that, too. I mean, you got to get to the fundamental reality of Barack Obama, that at his core, he's a lie. You know, that what you're seeing was created because that's what he wants you to see. You know, the whole routine of Barack Obama from the beginning, he's a radical politician. He didn't, you know, he lived in Chicago. He's mostly living on credit cards. He was gone half the time or more down to Springfield, Illinois. The wife was angry at him all the time. But yet he presents himself as this great family man and all the rest of it. I'm convinced that Jack Cashel is right, that Bill Ayers wrote Dreams for My Father. Barack Obama can't write anything. He can't speak without a teleprompter. How is he going to write a book?
I know he can't pronounce Corman and he can't pronounce Alzheimer's, so... Oh, no.
And yet it's George W. Bush that's the one who gets criticized as by the press as being stupid. See, Barack Obama appeals to the elite, and the elite in the United States since the end of the Vietnam War, as I say, you know, the David Horowitz is right about this. The far left, the new left, the communists and socialists, the Bill Ayers of the world, the Saul Alinskys, moved into the universities. And they decided they'd produce an elite group of students who were all socialist-trained, even though the students didn't know they were socialist-trained. One of the most popular history books in terms of U.S. history taught in universities for decades has been Howard Zinn's People History of the United States. Well, Howard Zinn was a communist. We now have the FBI papers released on him. He was a member of the Communist Party going back to 1948. He's the guy who wrote the history textbook about American history that generations of U.S. students have been taught. It's disgraceful. So now the Obama zombies who all voted for Barack Obama in college have no jobs, and they're wondering why they didn't get the hope and change they were promised. They got the hope and change they were promised. And next watch, we're just running in WorldNet Daily. We've been running a series of articles. Wait till Barack Obama puts this civilian corps in place. You know, we're going back to
that scared the hell out of me. I apologize for interrupting, but I was screaming about that well before the election, and no one would listen.
Well, it's back to the concept of the Hitler Youth. You've got to remember, and this is, you know, Jonas Goldberg is right. The left was the fascists. The left was always, you know, National Social Party was what the Nazis were. The Nazis competed with the communists in Germany for the left. And the idea of this Hitler Youth and the Barack Obama Civilian Corps, now the Obama zombies who voted for him are realizing that he's going to reinstitute the draft, and if they're not qualified for the draft, they have to do civilian service, and if they don't do that, they go to jail. That's Barack Obama.
Were you at all surprised? I think the exact statement, and I have a hard drive. I'm going to have to add a second hard drive to my computer because I've got so many video clips of Barack Obama saying outrageous things. But when someone actually came out, and I think the exact quote was, we need a civilian peacekeeping corps as large and as well-funded as the U.S. military.
Right, that's what he said.
Now,
we're running that in WorldNet Daily. We've been publishing that statement. Because, again, that's back to the core of who Barack Obama is. He means that.
It's absolutely amazing that no one said, well, Mr. President, do you realize how many people are serving in the U.S. military? Do you realize what a large percentage the U.S. military is of our overall budget? Where is the money going to come from to have a civilian peacekeeping corps as large and as well-funded as the U.S. military? No one even questioned, why would you not just appropriate more money for local police forces?
Well, one of the ironies here is that with Barack Obama, the far left has gotten their ultimate wet dream. They've gotten universal health care passed. It's like the cornerstone of the, once they get this, they think they have everything. They can promise people you know, cradle to grave, government will take care of you. The great irony of Obama is two great irony. One is that he exposed socialism and the left and the Democratic Party for what it is. You know, it's a communist party. It's what in Europe would be considered a social democrat party. It's not Democratic Party like Hubert Humphrey. It's social democrat, like in a European sense, which basically means communist. Secondly, we can't afford it. So when they finally put their crown jewel in place of universal health care, we're broke. And we're broke because of these programs. Now, that's happened over and over and over again with socialism, because socialism is not an economically sound theory. You can't just have government giveaways. I've got a good idea. Let's buy everybody their home and give them the mortgage. No, I mean, a better idea. Let's buy everybody's home, give them their mortgage, and send them $1 million. You know, I mean, that's socialism. And say, why can't we do that? Well, because it doesn't work. The minute you do that, the nation's broke, the currency's worthless, you might as well send them monopoly money. It doesn't work. But we've trained a generation of people coming out of the universities so poorly trained, so unable to think, so ignorant of history, they don't realize that that idea has been tried over and over and over again since in ancient Rome they had the formula grain and circus to keep the mob in tow. And it didn't work in ancient Rome. It won't work here.
You talk about Barack Obama being ignorant of history. One of the things we were promised prior to his being elected is that this guy was brilliant. He was internationally sophisticated. Unlike George W. Bush, or at that time potentially Sarah Palin, he was the kind of sophisticated individual who would not embarrass us on the world stage. Yet we continue to see examples of his lack of intellect, his lack of knowledge within the area of history, and frankly, his inability to be good at simple grade school math. I mean, Jeff Foxworthy had that show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? I would advise the Obama people not to let him on that show, because
it really
gets embarrassing.
When you get to where I am with looking at Barack Obama, where I'm at, whatever boast is made about Barack Obama, I reverse it, and that's the truth. So they say he's brilliant. Reverse it, he can barely read. That's probably the truth. Because whatever they boast about Obama, they're covering up a deficiency. It's the left that does this. Remember, it's all Saul Alinsky. It's better that he appears to be brilliant than that he is brilliant. That's mm-hmm. Machiavelli. That's right out of the print. You know, you don't need to be brilliant. People just have to think you're brilliant. Now, Barack Obama's IQ is measured by, you know, first of all, I'd love to be able to give this guy a real standardized test and measure him. He won't let you see his grades. He won't let you see whatever he did in these universities. He's never written anything except for the two books that are under his name, neither one of which I think he wrote at all. I think Bill Ayers wrote the first one, Dreams for My Father. Jack Canfield's right on that. And I think the second one was basically put together with his staff, cutting up a few policy papers and positions that somebody else had written, nameless person on the staff, and then adding a few passages that probably Bill Ayers flew in for an afternoon and polished up. But, you know, Bill Ayers can write. Lots of evidence Bill Ayers can write. He's very highly articulate. There's no evidence that Barack Obama can write. Put Barack Obama in a room with a sheaf of papers and a pencil. At the end of the day, you'll have doodles. That's how I look at Barack Obama. Put Ronald Reagan in a room with a sheaf of papers, and he'll do what he did. He'll pen out very brilliant, in his longhand, radio addresses about fundamental principles of American history, about the Founding Fathers. There's a book of Ronald Reagan's radio addresses that he hand wrote. They're brilliant. There's nothing like that for Barack Obama.
Nothing that I can see would lead one to suggest that he even graduated high school, let alone college, despite everyone's claim that he has a very high IQ and he's got the highest IQ of any president that ever served. And
except we can't see the IQ tests. Show me the IQ tests. Show me his grades. I want to see how well he did in his essay, you know, his test to get into college. I want to see how he did in his law school test. You're not going to see any of these things.
No.
If they exist, they're terrible.
I personally found it interesting when he said Austrians speak Austrian. I've mentioned this before on the radio, but I found it interesting that his knowledge of history is just amazing. He said America invented the automobile, and I'm thinking if Sarah Palin, Dan Quayle, George Bush had said any of these things, they would have been nailed to a cross for it. But he can just sit there and say these things with impunity. I mean,
the mainstream media is going to give Barack Obama a pass. That's why people don't read anymore. The New York Times, or the only people reading these papers are the elite. You know, take a look at the numbers. Fox, you've got 3 million people a night watching Bill O'Reilly. And when you take a look at MSNBC, they're lucky if they get 500,000. Okay, now that's the kind of proportions that we're talking about in terms of mainstream media, Time, Newsweek. These used to be in the 60s, these used to be publications that were must-read every week. Today, the only reason, I can think of, I quit reading the New York Times about 1969. I remember distinctly I was in college during the Vietnam War. I picked up one of the issues of the New York Times. I read it, and I said, I'm never reading this newspaper again, unless they fire everybody. Today, there's no reason to get a New York Times unless you're a complete socialist or you have a dog. Maybe if you have a dog, it'd be a good. You could use the New York Times.
Paper train.
But Matt, I don't see any point to it, and neither does the American people. Murdoch is dominating the media with Fox and with the Wall Street Journal, which he's using to very effectively compete with the New York Times. And it's just a question of how long publications like these, Boston Globe, Los Angeles Times. They're going to die away, and the socialists writing for them will end up writing for Daily Cause or something else, and have 25 people reading them. I'm just hoping that unfortunately, the economic pain we're going to go through is necessary to wake people up, and when people realize that they can take the college educations they've gotten in the last, 40 years, and basically take a look at what drivel they were taught. Go back and look at your college textbooks. And once the colleges started moving in the direction, I remember distinctly also being at Harvard in the 60s, and here come the Hispanic studies, the African studies, the women's studies. And I said, I'm just glad I'm getting out of here now, because the next wave of this is just going to be communism. And the communists don't teach anything except ideology. They rewrite history. Anything's inconvenient, they alter. Well, that's Barack Obama. Barack Obama has as little attachment to the historical fact as he has to his life history being true. It's what he wants it to be, is what you're being told. I've documented WorldNet Daily. What hospital was Barack Obama born at? Well, first they said it was Queens Medical, then they changed that and they said it was Kapiolani. And then all the websites that said Queens immediately just switched over and put in Kapiolani and didn't explain that they were making a correction. That's George Orwell. That's, redo everything in a minute and don't explain that you were wrong. It's rewriting history to be the politically correct at the instant. The economic pain we're going to go through, I think, in the next 20 years may wake up America to throw these socialists out and to get back to the fundamental principles that our founding fathers put into the Constitution, which are principles of individual freedom, private initiative, property, rights inalienable by our Creator, not by Barack Obama, but by Barack Obama who refuses to acknowledge God, except when it's politically important to acknowledge God. He takes his family over to St. John's across from the White House and goes to a service because he's being criticized for not doing so. I mean, that's his religious, that's the extent to his Christian religion beliefs. He belongs in Chicago to a black liberation theology church, and anytime liberation's in it, it's communist to begin with. And, James Cone and all the other revolutionaries who created this, and then as a good example that he really did understand the religion, once Barack Obama is pressed whether he knew Reverend Wright, he says, "I wasn't in church that day." I'm thinking immediately, you know, here we go back to, I'm looking at the Bible, Jesus looking to the disciples and say, "You guys are all going to renounce me. You know, before the cock crows three times, you'll say you don't know who I am." Well, it's Barack Obama. That's the extent of his
faith.
Well,
that wasn't the Jeremiah Wright he knew.
Was the Jeremiah Wright I thought he was? Yeah, well, he was exactly the Jeremiah Wright you thought he was, and that's why you were there for 20 years. And then when it's inconvenient, throw him under the bus. And be not criticized, not followed by the loving press that for some reason or other, the elite society, you know, the elite society in the next 20 years, the elite in New York, in Washington, in the press, on Wall Street, are going to get trounced. This is what this is why they're so afraid of the Tea Party movement. The Tea Party movement is not an elite movement. It's a middle American movement. It's the most fundamental realignment of American politics I've seen in my lifetime, and it's the only realignment of American politics in my lifetime that's given me any encouragement. Because the first one that's getting back to our founding fathers and principles. And it will reject, ultimately, once the Tea Party movement understands that the elite in New York and Washington, the media and government, in the universities, have been all in a conspiracy together on this leftist socialism that they've been taught and share, I think the Tea Party movement will grind them up and throw them out. I just want it to be done peacefully. I want it to be done with reasonable time. I don't want a French Revolution and guillotines in the streets. But we're coming to the same kind of a populist uprising against the elites that was behind the American and French Revolution. People just get tired of this after a while. And they realize that the elites have created it. Look, fire a million bureaucrats out of Washington tomorrow. You'd improve the country dramatically. You wouldn't miss them. Except that we'd have fewer regulations and we might actually get more things done. Shut down the Federal Reserve. Get rid of the IRS. Take any six departments you want and close them. People say, well, which six would you start with of the federal government? I say, truthfully, I don't care. Do it at random. Just get rid of six. State Department, fine. Pentagon, fine. Pentagon's now filled with socialists, too. It'd shock you to know how many of the people in the Pentagon and in the State Department are John Kerry supporters. And these are, people don't understand, again, not the U.S. military. I'm not talking about our troops in the field. I'm talking about the Wesley Clarks who run them. A lot of the true American patriotic military quit when Clinton was in, and as this don't ask, don't tell gets eliminated, and we have a gay army, who do you think is going to be running the Pentagon?
Excellent point. Let me ask you a hypothetical question. You talked about, you know, what five things you'd eliminate. If the U.S. federal government only provided the bare necessity of services, national security, roads and bridges and infrastructure and that type of thing, what do you think our tax rate could go down to?
Let's just eliminate the IRS altogether. The Founding Fathers didn't have it. And
that's
our
true.
Founding Fathers thought we could do on tariffs and other kinds of duties that we would impose. I'm sure we can have a fair tax or some other structure to go to. This is going to be one of my major themes, I think, for 2011. The Founding Fathers' vision of what, and it's considered extreme in America to talk about the Founding Fathers. That's what the elite wants everybody to think. We're extremists. Because, well, if we're extremists, and I'm going to be lumped together with, you know, Patrick Henry and Benjamin Franklin and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, I'll take that designation any day. The Founding Fathers' vision of the Constitution was that we needed a federal government for very limited reasons. Remember, they were coming out of the Articles of Confederation. They created a very weak federal government. And it didn't work for only a couple of reasons. One, interstate commerce. The states couldn't each impose their own taxes, tariffs. The states had to work together on commerce. That they understood that, the Founding Fathers. Secondly, national defense. They didn't want to eliminate militias, but they knew that there was a need occasionally for a standing army to defend the states together. And the original concept was that the states were sovereign and the federal government was created for a limited purpose. We've had this, you know, this principle of subsidiary government put into place where the federal government is considered supreme and the state subsidiary to it. That was not the original understanding. And I think in the next 20 years, we're going to come to see a change, a states' rights movement that is unlike any that has been seen in this country since the Civil War. We need to get back to state and local government, let the local communities run the schools, not even the states. Let the local community, and if people don't like the schools in the local community, go to move. But, you know, if you gave the local communities control over the schools, you could break the power of the teachers' union. You could stop teaching, you know, the sexual agenda that they want taught in the schools. And you get back
Father
to
has
teaching.
Two mommies, daddy's roommate.
Right. You get back to teaching the children how to actually do fundamental skills, which is what they're there for. You know, the only reason you've got skills is that children are not born able to read. They're not born able to do mathematics. They have to have some instruction in how to do these fundamental things. And, you know, instead, children weren't born needing to have Hispanic studies. That's an ideological agenda. Schools don't need to be teaching an ideological agenda. They'd be teaching fundamental skills that have to do with technical abilities. It used to be reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that formula? It's that Spanish studies, women's studies, and gay studies.
It's amazing to me what's happened in the schools, see, even in my lifetime. I was educated in a private school from kindergarten through 8th and then attended a public school 9th through 12th. And, you know, I've got to tell you, Mr. Corsi, it was a zoo. I could not believe, you know, I'm talking teachers, principals that had to constantly roam the schools looking for trouble. And, of course, now you go back to the same schools and they have police officers all over the place. And even then, back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, you could see what was coming. And it's I actually know one high school teacher who was physically assaulted by a student. And when he informed administration that he was going to the police on the matter, they said, they pointed to a law that said that the school could not divulge students' records. And of course, that was meant to mean academic records, not something like this. But they said if he went to the police, he would be violating the students' right to privacy in terms of their academic record, and told him he would be terminated if he went to the police regarding the assault. And one can only wonder if he had witnessed the student killing someone, if the school board would have allowed him to go to the police, or if that would have been considered a violation of the student's right to privacy. It's just amazing what's happened.
Yeah, sending your children to public school today in high school level, you don't know whether the child's going to come home. You don't know if it's going to be another Columbine. I mean, if it was told the truth of how many kids are on the Internet making up death lists, thinking about guns. I mean, you know, look, you're dealing with adolescents, first of all, and you've got a lot of instability and issue of emotional development there. You add in all these other elements of the schools. If you want to see what socialism looks like, go to Detroit. It's half the size it was in 1950. There's no jobs. They're bulldozing vacant properties and turning them into farmland. It's dominated by a minority that can't read, can't write, can't be educated, can't do jobs, out of marriage children, abortions, the percentages are alarming, broken families. You can't produce, and without government aid, what would you do with it? How would Detroit survive? There's nothing economically productive going on in Detroit anymore. That's the end result of socialism. And there's an internet email going around comparing Detroit 1950 to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, two cities that we dropped A-bombs on at the end of World War II to end the war. Well, those are thriving cities right now compared to Detroit and Cleveland. You know, these are the cities that are produced by socialism. The end result of this government dependency and government giveaways is bankruptcy. It's dependent people on government. It's the inability to raise children to be able to be have skills that could produce for survival or any moral values. It's, you know, they used to say when I grew up, atheistic communism. They won't even say that anymore because it's politically incorrect. Communism is atheistic. It wants to put human beings at the center of all reason and supreme intelligence. Well, I'm sorry, human beings typically are not much smarter than dogs. Dogs, at least a dog, you know, if you feed the dog is going to recognize you and treat you nicely the rest of your life. If you feed a human being, it's not clear what the human being is going to do.
You take a look at Greece.
Take a look at Greece. And the problem is that, you know, when we're having Barack Obama and the agenda to take God out of everything, take even down this cross in the middle of the Mojave Desert that was put there by World War I veterans, that cross has got to come down. If they're that rabid, you know, somebody better get these guys a Bible. And they better say to them, look, this is the Bible. I know you don't believe in it. I know you think it's trash, just political, you know, written to control your mind. You believe all the Marxist things about it. But would you please find one passage in here where people disrespected God and God blessed them? And I'm reading it. These people disrespected God, he destroys them. Their civilization's wiped out. The judgment of God comes down on them. I said, now, I know you don't believe any of that, but just find me one example where the people abused God in this book, and God blessed them. Then we can begin the discussion. Well, they don't get it. They don't understand what our founding fathers did, and that is that we do have a human nature, but it is rooted in God. It is derived from a moral understanding. And if you violate those principles, you're not going to be much better than a dog. Dogs have morals. Dogs think. They have morals. I mean, come on. Dog will recognize you. It's a great story in Odysseus, you know, the Homer. He's gone for all these years, wandering around since the Battle of Troy. He comes home decades later. Who recognizes him? The dog.
You know, in addition to Detroit and Cleveland, some other cities that you threw out there, one need only go back to the embarrassing sights that we were all treated to on national television during Katrina. This was a group of, I mean, New Orleans was and is a welfare state. I think the nickname that came out for them was rooftoppers. I mean, these were people who didn't bother leaving New Orleans because they were sitting around and waiting on the government to tell them what to do.
Right.
It's embarrassing.
Well, and, you know, if you take a look at any of these situations where people get government dependent, the complaint is they want government to do more for them. This is one of the big problems we're seeing now in France and in Greece. We're going to see it here. Once people have been promised all these benefits, they don't know what they're going to do without them. In France, they're rioting in the streets because they have to work until 62 years old instead of retiring at 60. Give me a break.
I'm spoiled. Poor Megan Kelly. Boo-hoo-hoo.
You know, they're throwing around baguettes at each other. You know, they have to put down their pâté for a minute and their chablis so that they can go out in the streets and protest that they got to work for two more years.
Oh, well, God forbid that you get less than 3 months of vacation, too.
Yeah, right. And, you know, look, we're there, too. Now, the only reason it'll break in the United States is the same reason it's breaking in Greece, and that is we can't afford it anymore. So go ahead and pass universal health care. Great. Give everybody a right to health care, all they want. And then when they come in to get it, I'm saying, you know, it's like it's going to remind me of the Monty Python cheese shop routine. Guy comes into the cheese shop and, you know, do you have any brie? No, I'm sorry, we're out of that today. How about some cheddar? Well, it's very good, but the cat ate it. There's no cheese in the cheese shop. Well, under universal health care, there's going to be no medical care in the hospital. Because who's going to do it? Bureaucrats? There'll be books written. There'll be, you know, a shelf of books about how your medical treatment ought to be done. Any doctor who looks at these is going to say, I'm out of here. I'm either not going to be a doctor or I'm going to go to somewhere where I don't have to look at these rules. Because I want to heal people. I didn't come into medicine because I want to read the rules. You know, I came into medicine because I want to heal people. Well, you know, that's what's going to happen with the socialism. People are going to get their Social Security check. They're going to get $2,000. And good luck buying a cup of coffee and a hamburger with that. And we're headed there. And that's So when I watched them pass the universal health care, you know, I tempered my anger about it, my feeling this was destructive to the future of America, by my realization that it didn't have a snowball's chance of actually being done. They're going to write a lot of rules, create a lot of committees, they're going to force a lot of people out of medicine, make a lot of doctors think about retiring, but they're not going to heal anybody with this. They're not going to get anybody into the hospital. They're just going to make you have to think, you know, where do I go to find a doctor when I'm really sick? It's going to force it into a situation where the people who are medically gifted at birth are discouraged from pursuing careers in medicine because there's no money to be made in it, and they don't want the regulations. And then if you do make any money, it's taken from you by the government. And if you do anything wrong, you're put in jail. And if you don't do the abortions and everything else they demand you to do, you don't get to practice. Well, you know, very few doctors really want to spend their career killing babies. You know, a doctor who spent their career, they spent 40 years in medicine and they gave birth to babies, will be celebrated when they die. What do you do with a guy who said, well, for 40 years he killed babies, killed 5,000 a year? Okay, well, at 40 years, how many babies did he kill? Are we going to celebrate this guy?
There are a lot of physicians that I am friends with who are telling me that they are encouraging their children not to go into medicine now because of Obamacare. And I can only wonder where the physicians of the future are going to come from, as some of our best and brightest are being encouraged by their parents to find another occupation.
Well, my hope is, and my confidence is, in the American people and the fundamental awareness, when people understand this, when these issues, you know, I get excoriated regularly for talking like this by the Media Matters and the other elitists that want to preserve their socialist agenda. I don't care. I couldn't care less what they say. The American people, when they realize this nonsense, are going to go into Washington and they're going to shut down the bureaucracy. We are going to close the IRS, and we're going to close the Federal Reserve. We're going to cut off their money. Without money, these elitists are not going to be able to advance their agenda. And then we're going to get it back to smaller government. We're going to get the teachers' union thrown out of the schools, and we're going to put up God back into the public sector. And maybe the next generations that come through our universities will be trained, the founding fathers, instead of being trained on Howard Zinn's People's History of America. And the best thing that's happening with the baby boomers, with the generation, is that they're dying. And I'm included in that. This generation goes, everybody has to celebrate, the worst generation in American history. Spoiled, made to be leftists after Vietnam. Once this generation passes through, maybe the generations of kids following that don't have any jobs, that don't have any prospects, are going to go back and read Thomas Paine and the Federalist Papers and realize that this was understood before. And we were given the principles that we need to put into place in order to advance and build wealth and to believe in God. And if we get back to those moral principles, if we get back to the principles of individual initiative, back to responsibility, back to local control, I think we've got a chance in America. These are the things that I think are coming because of the crisis that we're headed toward. And I don't think Americans, you know, when the crisis occurs and they tell us our currency's broke and we've got to go to the IMF for salvation, I hope the American people say, no, we don't have to do that. What we have to do is throw you out of government. What we have to do is shut down the Federal Reserve. These are the things.
Well, you mentioned the Federalist Papers. I'm sorry for interrupting. You mentioned the Federalist Papers. As much as the mainstream media likes to portray the Tea Party movement as just a bunch of ignorant hicks, as I've gone from Tea Party to Tea Party, and hopefully you'll find this encouraging, I cannot begin to count the number of people who have recently reread the Declaration of Independence, recently reread the Federalist Papers. These are the people who get it. These are the people who are familiar with these documents. It's the elitist in America, and a lot of the people who voted for the chosen one, who probably couldn't tell you, you know, a single line from the Declaration of Independence or a single line from the Constitution.
Well, they had to get those documents out of the schools as quickly as they were trying to get God out of the schools. The only reason they don't put Marx in the schoolrooms is because socialists were taught to lie. Saul Alinsky was not brilliant in his technique. He was the core. Socialists knew the only way. Marxists knew the only way they could get their principles put into place was they lied. And they say, oh, we're so much smarter than everybody else. We'll lie for their good. No, they lied because they wanted to be the elitist. And they figured out this scam where if they could perpetrate it, they could take everybody else's money and use it for their own. It's a worthless idea at its core. Nobody who wanted to work would ever be a socialist. Nobody who cared to be a doctor or to be a teacher, an educator, who was motivated by the fundamental moral desire to advance another human being without controlling that human being, would be a Marxist. Marxist is all about control. It's all about loss of liberty. It's all about tyranny. I mean, you know, these are principles. I think we have to get, Mark Levin understood this. I think his book, Liberty and Tyranny, captures it. I think Glenn Beck gets it when he's talking about, you know, common sense, Thomas Paine, and his exposition on communism and Marxism and radicals on television and Fox is brilliant because it's bringing some of these concepts down to a way, to a level where people can get them. He's showing it to them. He's illustrating it to them. He's entertaining. He's doing a tremendous service just to get this information out there. And this is what the American people are responding to. American people, you know, truth has a strong appeal. Unfortunately, truth has to be reintroduced from time to time in human history, and it only gets reintroduced when slavery is upon us. And, you know, again, the American people have always been underestimated. The British never thought we would win the Revolutionary War. There was never a thought that we could defeat Hitler and Imperial Japan. Certainly Hitler and Tojo didn't think we could. And, you know, the idea that the American people will eventually rise up and throw everything out that's been done since Franklin Roosevelt is the thing that keeps me going. I think the Tea Party movement is headed there. I think the Tea Party movement will begin to demonstrate this. If the Republican Party doesn't get it, after the Tea Party movement throws out the Democrats, the Tea Party movement will next throw out the Republicans. If the Republicans think that they can return to being the party of Lindsey Graham, Michael Steele better rethink it. Because that's not going to cut it. Tea Party movement.
No, and I love the Sean Hannity quote. He was talking to all these Republicans who are going to enjoy the benefit of the Tea Party wave to sweep them back into office.
Well, you know,
and he said that they're on probation. You guys right. Need to know you're going to be on probation.
Well, this is where I think Sean Hannity gets it. I think Sean has done a tremendous service over years, fighting every day as he does, and Rush Limbaugh. You know, these guys are just like Mark Levin. These guys are our heroes. They've been out there fighting this battle. I've been honored to be on their shows. And these are the guys who are advancing. Laura Ingraham, Ann Coulter. I mean, these are people who have been out there really advancing the agenda to get the American people to come on back to sense and to come back to reason. And that's why they have such large audiences, because they're resonating with the American people who have seen the fruits of what the socialists have done. And it encourages me that, Karl Rove doesn't get it. Karl Rove will still put down even Sarah Palin because she's not establishment enough for him. He doesn't understand that the rough edges around Sarah Palin are what in fact make her credible to the average person. You know, the polish and the numbers, as good as Karl Rove is, he's still an establishment guy. And the establishment guys who are encouraging, saying, oh, well, the Tea Party's put together candidates that might not win, but if they had just really stuck with the typical Republican candidates, they might have won. Who needs the typical Republican candidates if you can't distinguish them from Democrats?
And oh, exactly. I was shocked when Rhodes came out after Christine O'Donnell won the primary and attacked her the way he did. I beg your pardon?
He trashed her.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just amazing. And you're right, he doesn't get it, and I think that made it obvious. And what about the behavior of Crist in Florida and Murkowski in Alaska? I mean, it's just, these are spoiled brats who have decided, you know, to, as Sean Hannity was saying, pick up their toys and go home, you know, if they couldn't be quarterbacked. It's amazing.
They remind me, I was watching Crist the other day. I was trying to think, watching him trying to explain, you know, how he had tried to work with Clinton to get Meeks to drop out of the race. So I was watching this guy. What does this guy remind me? I was saying, it reminds me of something. I said, you know what this guy reminds me of is, if you've ever been fishing and you take a fish out of the water and, you know, you got the hook out of its mouth and you put it down on the deck of the boat or on land or put it in your ice box or whatever, that fish flops around for a while before it dies. So that's what it reminded me. Crist reminds me of a fish about to die because flopping around out of the water, doesn't know where he is, kind of out of context, but still gasping for air. These people don't realize that they've lost and that they've been rejected. And they still think if they just get one more breath, they can get back into the water and swim. They don't realize they're done and they're flopping around. And that's where the Republican Party itself is going to be after the Tea Party movement has enough time to convince America that it's here to stay and that it's serious movement. It's a realignment of American politics that has some fundamental goals in mind, and the goals are reduction of government and quitting of this insane spending and getting back to local control. And once the politicians in Washington, and what you're seeing right now is the elite media, the elite government, they're all like the fish out of water. They're all like Charlie Crist. They're all grasping for air. They all think that they can basically yet survive if only they can make it a little bit more. And they trash the Tea Party, and they trash anybody who, you know, they laugh at anybody who really aspires to go back to the principles of the Founding Fathers. They use George Soros' money with Media Matters and the others to attack everybody. And the elite media continues to repeat their attacks. Well, let them go ahead, and every quarter we can read that there's 5% fewer people reading newspapers. You know, Katie Couric's got nobody watching her at all. Well, that's where the mainstream media is headed, and it's headed there for the same reasons I think the American people. You know, this system is bankrupt. Where the left has taken us is, since Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt, is now full circle. And if Barack Obama did anything, he exposed, finally, for full view, like I tried to write in The Abomination, the lying, duplicity, and self-serving nature of communism. And they say, oh, we can't call anybody a communist. You know, that's McCarthyism. Yeah, well, McCarthy had a point. A lot of the people, including Alger Hiss, who he pointed out as communists, now we've got the Verona Papers, they document we're communists, you know, and people don't understand that we fight communism for one reason, and that is that communism is equivalent to slavery, tyranny, and death. And we've got to understand these principles in a fundamental way to understand that our founding fathers understood them. And they gave us a great gift in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and it's, you know, like Ben Franklin said, it, you know, you've got a great constitutional republic if you can keep it. And that's where I think every generation has to fight anew in order to go back to those principles, because this is a never-ending battle. But the left has got to be pushed back, because the left, you know, the left of Hubert Humphrey could be tolerated. The left of Bill Ayers has to be thrown out, if not just put into jail for the people they've killed.
What one of the benefits here of Blog Talk Radio is that we can go over on time. And even though we have gone over, I cannot let you out of here without giving us your prediction for November 2nd. What's going to happen in the Senate? What's going to happen in the House? Is there any race in particular that we're going to wake up Wednesday morning and look at the newspaper and say, okay, I'm going to be honest, I don't read the newspaper anymore, not the print version, but when we look at the internet or turn on the television, is there a race that's going to be a shocker?
Yes,
someone's
going to
say,
a
oh my
few.
Goodness.
I think, first of all, the Republicans will take back the House with a comfortable margin. Maybe even an historic margin. And the Senate, 50-50, the Republicans might take back the Senate. It's going to be down to one or two seats.
Mm-hmm.
And the governors, I think the Republicans will pick up maybe 7, maybe 8 governor races, which is going to be very important because of the redistricting coming and because of the preparation for 2012. With Republican governors in office, we have a chance of reducing the Democratic voter fraud that will be perpetrated again in 2012. Remember, the far left does not have any moral principles at all. They will easily steal elections if they could, and Al Franken's a clear example of that. I think there will be some surprises. I don't think Murkowski has a chance. I think Crist will be soundly trounced. I think a couple of the races that the polls are now showing to be close are going to be not so close in favor of candidates who may even be down. There'll be a couple surprises, whether it's that Farina beats Boxer or O'Donnell wins. One of these campaigns is going to be so off on the polls. Or in Massachusetts, the Deval goes down. There's going to be a couple of races that people didn't even think about because they were going on the polls, and the polls, I think, are going to be wrong this year in estimating turnout. I think the turnout is going to be from the conservative side and the middle. The independents are going to swing solidly toward the Republican Party, and polls, which have been going on traditional estimates of who's going to turn out and voter enthusiasm, are going to have underpredicted the wave of anger and throw them out that's in the country. The other thing is, as soon as the Republicans get in, they need to be reminded that they're on a short reprieve and that they better stop abusing Jim DeMint. They better start listening to the American people. Lindsey Graham better figure out his next career, and John McCain, if he returns to Washington, better stop joining with his buddy Ted Kennedy's ghost to do the next immigration reform bill. So, you know, there's going to be a wakening up in the Republican Party, and the Congress that takes over, it's going to be a much more conservative Congress and much more rebellious Congress against Obama. I don't think there's going to be a possibility of a Gingrich. You know, the best thing I think that can happen to the Congress in the next 2 years is gridlock and just block the Obama agenda. We're going to have to fight the Obama agenda through the bureaucracy. They're going to try to do cap and trade through the Environmental Protection Agency. They're going to try to do gays in the military through the Pentagon. The Obama administration is going to try to do everything now. Now you're going to see why the czars were put into place, and it's to circumvent the Congress. The Obama administration will not change. He will not moderate. He'll just morph and try to do everything he wanted to do through administrative rules. And the only thing that will stop Obama is that we're broke. And right after the election, when they recommend a value-added tax, in addition to the income tax, Americans, I think, will soundly reject it. And then they'll start the crisis of the dollar. They'll try to collapse the dollar to throw us into an international monetary fund, one world currency. And we're going to have to fight that.
Yeah.
But the next big battle is the recognition that we're bankrupt. And that recognition will be brought upon America shortly after the November election. the elite know it now. They're just hiding. They're doing more quantitative easing. They're having the Fed getting ready to buy more Treasury debt. They're trying to keep the truth from the American people, at least until after the election. But the truth is the United States is bankrupt. The dollar is debased. And we're going to have a very difficult period of time here with economics. And we're going to have to resist the globalist agenda one more time. That's why America for Sale is in paperback. And by the way, my Red Alert newsletter is now free. You can subscribe to it at redalert.wnd.com for WorldNet Daily. And Guilford Securities, where I'm a managing director, you can go to guilfordsecurities.com and subscribe there. And, you know, I head the financial services group. If you click that tab, you can fill out the form and enroll with Guilford Securities. And I think I'm hopeful because I think that the battle we're on is one that we're going to increasingly be winning. And this is a battle for middle America. I hope the Tea Party movement stays decentralized. It does not need a national leader. I hope it stays locally motivated. And it's as important right now to fight for the school board elections as it is to fight for who's the next presidential candidate. Maybe more important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd like to see the Tea Party take over every school board in America and actually go back and unscrub God from our history.
City council, get in the local school boards, get control of local government, because people are going to need some communities in some states to live in. And there's going to be some that are going to be better than others. California may be unlivable, except, you know, for the direction it's going with taxes and crime and illegal immigration and all the marijuana and all the other problems that California wants to bring on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas other states like Arizona may get an attorney general who wants to fight these battles, and Arizona may be saying, we're going to send the National Guard to the border to protect Arizonans, and if Obama doesn't like it, he can send in the federal troops to get us out. I think that's where I see the states' rights movement heading, into we don't want this federal government anymore. And there will be, and if people, state legislatures, down to the school boards, these are elections people have got to start focusing on. Okay, it's been great.
So everyone out there listening, you know, let's get some Tea Partiers on the local school boards.
Absolutely.
And start taking back our schools at the ground level.
Start rewriting these textbooks, throwing these textbooks out, get new textbooks in that teach principles of God, founding fathers, private enterprise, individual liberty. Let's get those textbooks into the schools. Get the ideological agenda out. Get teachers in who can or are gifted at teaching children fundamental skills, reading, writing, arithmetic, history, basic skills that they need in order to live productive lives as free citizens of a constitutional republic. Let's get back to that idea of citizenship and begin it in the schools.
That's where it all starts. You give the liberals credit for one thing, give the socialists credit for one thing. They're very patient. And they've spent decades taking over our schools, knowing that it would take a long time. And they've now got the control that they always dreamed of. And I think we need to start, like you said, at the local level, the school board level, and be as patient as they were, although perhaps not as much, and gradually begin taking back the schools and returning, like you said, the core curriculum, the reading, the writing, and the arithmetic, and teach an accurate version of history and allow the students to know that God was very important to our founding fathers. So that would be a great start. But as you said, the socialists, they've got the schools from kindergarten through grad school, and there's only one way that we're going to be able to resolve that, and that's to gradually start taking them back ourselves, perhaps implementing the same patience that they used, they took over the education system. Couldn't agree with you more. And I'm hoping that what you've just said will be a call to action.
I think it will be. People will hear it. And we, you know, the Tea Party, the United States has been through tough hours and tough times before. I've got great confidence in the American people. I don't think God created the United States of America to have it be taken over by a group of socialists and communists who want to destroy America and destroy God. And I think we return to these fundamental principles. We have everything we need to win, and we will win. It takes some time. It can be done. We have all the tools we need to do it through the ballot box and to do it peacefully. With the dedication people are putting into this, and people will have to put it in because they see that the alternative is a future they don't want to live in, and they don't want their children living in. But I'm quite confident we can turn it back, because God did not put into human nature the aspiration to live under slavery, to live under tyranny.
Dr. Corsi, we've run out of time today, but I hope we can have you back as a guest sometime soon.
Well, God bless you, Mark. Good to talk to you, and I'll be happy to come back anytime you ask.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.